SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to. From the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandame Ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandame. Coming up in your program this Wednesday, the 27th of March, Victoria's Truth Telling Commission traveled to the site where colonization began in the southwest of the state. It's the first formal truth-telling process of its type in Australia, charged with investigating both historical and ongoing injustices committed against Aboriginal Victorians. Also on NITV Radio today, conversation with Jack Gilmer, recipient of the 2024 Galang Program, an art residency in Paris that enables First Nations creative practitioners who are based in Australia to undertake their work in Paris. Also coming up on your program today, we'll hear how the government's changes to prescribing rules in 2020 appear to have been effective in reducing dramatically the use of opioids in Australia. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, anti-corruption watchdog finds evidence racist awards were issued by an elite Northern Territory police unit. The federal opposition sends the government's immigration deportation laws to a Senate inquiry. And the United States rejects Israeli claims a UN ceasefire resolution has damaged negotiations with Hamas. An anti-corruption body investigating claims of racism within the Northern Territory's elite police unit has found evidence to support the allegation. A series of racist award certificates allegedly handed out by the Forces Territory Response Group came to light in February at a coroner inquest into the death of Indigenous man Kumanjayi Walker. The certificates triggered a joint investigation into improper conduct within the unit by the NT Police and the Northern Territory Independent Commissioner Against Corruption, Michael Riches. Mr. Riches says evidence collected so far supported the allegation that awards had been issued within the Territory Response Group that were racist towards Aboriginal people. Victoria's Truth-Telling Commission has begun hearings into historic injustices related to land, skies and waters on Gundijmara country. The Yorok Justice Commission travelled to the site where colonisation began in the southwest of the state, hearing evidence of theft and massacres from local elders and traditional owners. Commissioners were taken to the site of the Convincing Ground Massacre, Victoria's first recorded massacre. Commissioner Travis Lovett says the site was emblematic of broader colonial violence against First Nations people.
It is there that European whalers used their guns to fend off the Kilgara Gundij people from accessing their own resources, which they had done for thousands of years prior. First people's land, water and resources were illegally and forcibly taken. We were denied access and the ability to practice our culture and speak our language. Our ancestors were slaughtered in massacres.
Traditional owners have described Labor's approach to offshore gas development as a betrayal that breaches international law. A group of First Nations people, including Riley and Kopa from several songlines, have written and published a letter to Indigenous Australians Minister Linda Burney, Assistant Minister Malandir McCarthy, and Lingiari MP Marion Scrimshaw. The letter calls on the federal government to listen to Indigenous voices and claims an amendment to offshore gas legislation is intended to remove their consultation rights to be heard on developments in sea country that affect cultural heritage and songlines. Josie Alec, the First Nations lead from the Australian Conservation Foundation, was among those who signed the letter.
With these projects going ahead, we will damage those futures. Our children and their lives are at stake here. These bills that are being put through, these legislative bills being put through, trying to silence our voices as First Nations people, cannot be done. We need to stop this and we need to create a better way forward.
The government says it has added an environmental safeguard to the proposed legislation, requiring both the Environment and Resources Ministers to approve changes to consultation processes. The Northern Territory's most powerful land council has criticised the government's handling of ex-tropical cyclone Megan, saying vulnerable people were left cold, hungry and in danger. The severe weather event tore through northeast Northern Territory on March 17, bringing heavy wind and rain and cutting off communities. An evacuation of the remote community of Bururula on March 18 was called off after Australian Defence Force planes could not land as the eye of the cyclone neared. In a statement, Northern Land Council Chair Matthew Ryan says the government's response was inadequate and put residents in danger. A minister in the Northern Territory government, Mark Monaghan, has defended his government's response.
And the bottom line with it is, if no one dies in these spaces, how could you say it was a horror? At the end of the day, that's our job, to keep people safe. And we did that with the emergency team and the incident controller managing that.
The Federal Opposition and the Greens have sent the government's proposed legislation to make it easier to deport immigration detainees to a Senate inquiry. The bill would impose a prison sentence of up to 5 years on people refusing to cooperate with their deportation, with a mandatory sentence of 1 year. Home Affairs Secretary Stephen Foster fronted a two-hour Senate committee hearing last night after the bill passed in the lower house. Opposition Home Affairs spokesperson James Patterson says they haven't got the answers they need on the legislation.
They couldn't explain how or when they would use this legislation or who it would apply to. In light of that, it's very difficult for the Coalition to support such a rushed passage of this legislation. We are very concerned about unintended consequences.
Australian politicians have welcomed a ruling that Julian Assange will not be extradited to the United States and may be able to appeal the extradition order. The High Court in London has ruled that Mr. Assange will not be immediately extradited to the United States until it provides assurances he will not face the death penalty and can use the United States First Amendment in his legal defense. Independent federal MP Andrew Wilkie introduced a successful motion of support for Mr. Assange in the lower house last month. He says the court's decision to adjourn the appeal until May the 20th is good news.
The delay is good in itself. Getting those assurances are good in themselves. But what I think is even better than all of that, it does give us a three-week window for Julian's legal team and for Julian himself to perhaps cut a deal with the US Department of Justice.
Back home, the Albanese government has defended its record after a decision to water down its fuel efficiency laws ahead of their presentation in Parliament today. Transport Minister Catherine King and Energy Minister Chris Bowen revealed the government's final plans for new vehicle rules yesterday, under which utes and large SUVs will not have to be as green as initially proposed. The fuel efficiency laws, which were the subject of continued criticism by the opposition, will also pose penalties for exceeding emission targets for the first 6 months of its operation. The United States says Israeli claims a UN Security Council ceasefire resolution has hindered hostage talks are inaccurate and unfair. Israel has called negotiators from Qatar, saying Hamas was not interested in talks after the resolution called for an immediate ceasefire not dependent on the release of more than 100 Israeli hostages. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has said the resolution, supported by all Security Council members apart from the U.S., which abstained, shows Israel is losing diplomatic protection after the deaths of more than 32,000 Palestinians. The U.S. is working to persuade Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to consider alternatives to a ground invasion of Rafah after Mr. Netanyahu cancelled a delegation to the U.S. following the vote. But U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller says Israel has misrepresented Hamas's response to the hostage release proposal also contained in the resolution.
That statement is inaccurate in almost every respect, and it is unfair to the hostages and their families. The description of Hamas's response that has been aired in the public is all from news reports. It's not the actual substance of the response, and I can tell you that that response was prepared before the UN Security Council vote, not after it. We are going to continue work to try to bring the hostages home.
New research has found carbon credit projects that claim to fight climate change by regrowing Australia's forests are largely failing. 10 Australian academics have published a paper analysing 182 projects that use the controversial human-induced regeneration method to generate carbon credits for the offset market. The projects are supposed to capture climate change-causing gases like carbon dioxide by regenerating native forests or through land use changes, allowing companies to offset their emissions. Australian National University professor Andrew McIntosh says researchers found almost 80% of the projects experienced negative or negligible change in tree cover over the study period. And to sport, Essendon forward Peter Wright says players need to adjust to how high hits are adjudicated after becoming the latest star to receive a suspension from the sports tribunal. Wright has been suspended for 4 matches for an airborne hit that led to Sydney defender Harry Cunningham being concussed. Meanwhile, St Kilda forward Max King has failed to overturn a 1-match ban for a glancing head-high bump on Collingwood's Finlay McRae. The pair joined St Kilda's Jimmy Webster, suspended for 7 matches for a brutal pre-season hit on North Melbourne's skipper Jai Simkin, with the AFL desperate to reduce the amount of concussions in the game. And now having a look at the weather around the country, Broome, sunny 31, Perth, similar conditions 32, Adelaide, also sunny 25, Melbourne, a shower 221, Hobart, cloudy 20, Albury-Wodonga, sunny 27, Canberra, partly cloudy 26, Wollongong, a shower 223, Sydney, possible shower 25, Newcastle, showers 27, Brisbane, rain 26, Townsville, light thunderstorms and rain, top of 30 degrees, Cairns, showers 31, Alice Springs, mostly cloudy, 26. Darwin, showers and a possible storm, a top of 33 degrees. And the Torres Strait Islands, scattered thunderstorms and 32 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandami and you're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Wednesday afternoon. Coming up next, conversation with Jack Gilmer, who is about to embark on an art residency in Paris. As you'll hear, throughout his residency, Jack will investigate the display and treatment of indigenous artifacts and collection, reckoning with the colonial history of museology and the future of cultural material acquisition and exhibition. Also in the program today, we'll hear how the government's changes to prescribing rules in 2020 appear to have been effective in reducing dramatically the use of opioids in Australia. But first, the Yuruk Justice Commission has begun hearings into injustices against Victoria's First Nations peoples related to land, sky and waters.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
Victoria's Truth-Telling Commission has held a ceremonial hearing on Gundijmara country as it begins inquiries into historic injustices related to land, skies and waters. The Euro Justice Commission travelled to the site where colonisation actually started in Victoria. The commission will hear evidence of theft and massacres from local elders and traditional owners. Sam Dover reports.
The sounds of a Gundijmara smoking ceremony, just one sign of a culture that is still strong and thriving in the face of colonisation. Their stories are now being heard as part of Victoria's Truth-Telling Commission at the site where the state's colonisation started, near Portland in southwestern Victoria at the Tayrac Aquaculture Centre. Commissioner Travis Lovett opened the historic hearings.
As a proud Kerepmara Gundijmara man and as a commissioner of the Yurluk Justice Commission, it is a great honour to stand here on country or meeting for the historic opening of the land justice hearings, land injustice. Justice hasn't been done yet.
The Yurluk Justice Commission will listen to testimonies of injustices against Victoria's First Nations people in a first-of-its-kind truth-telling inquiry. The ceremonial hearing in Tayrac begins 3 weeks of evidence into issues relating to land, skies and waters.
First Peoples' land, water and resources were illegally and forcibly taken. We were denied access and the ability to practice our culture and speak our language. Our ancestors were slaughtered in massacres.
The loss of land and resources and the impact of that on First Nations peoples to this day forms a key part of the Yurluk inquiry. Elders took commissioners to nearby Kotesh, showing them ancient eel traps and a smoking tree where Gundijmara people cured eels. This area of Victoria is particularly significant for the Commission's evidence as the nearby town of Portland was the first permanent European settlement in the state. Commissioners were also shown the site of the Convincing Ground Massacre, Victoria's first recorded massacre site.
It is there that European whalers used their guns to fend off the Kilgar Gundij people from accessing their own resources, which they had done for thousands of years prior.
These Yurluk hearings are the first formal truth-telling process of its type in Australia, charged with investigating both historical and ongoing injustices committed against Indigenous Victorians. Auntie Donna Wright, a member of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, says the commission holds massive significance for her people and her family in particular.
We are the modern-day warriors now taking over that legacy, especially here as we bore the brunt of colonisation. To talk about the injustices inflicted on generations of our children. My mother was stolen from the mission where she grew up with her parents. She didn't get to grow up in a loving home. She was taken. So to be here today, to be here at the Yurluk hearings is very important for our family, especially my mother.
She says for a long time Australia has glorified its colonial history and processes like these hearings will ensure Australians have a true and honest understanding of their history.
And in this part of our country there's a glorification of the colonisers who stole our land, the massacres, the murders, the frontier violence, violence against our women, but our children as well. And it did not stop us. We're still here and we're still fighting.
This won't be the only on-country hearing for the Yurluk inquiry. The state's water minister will give evidence to the inquiry in Robin Vale on the Murray River, and Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen is set to give evidence in Wurundjeri country on land that was previously part of the Corranderk Aboriginal Mission. This will mark the first time the Premier will appear as a witness at a commission. I'm Sam Dover for SBS News, and this story was produced in collaboration with Cameron Gooley for NITV News.
NITV Radio, share our stories on Facebook.
Now we must go to a break. But stay with us, because when we come back, we have a conversation with Jack Gilmer, a recipient of a prestigious art residency at the Cité Internationale des Arts in Paris. Jack Gilmer is an artist and also an architect, and in our conversation, Jack will share insights into his projects as an art resident in Paris. Stay tuned.
You're with NITV Radio.
He was born in Asia Minor, a colonised Jewish man. His father, the village carpenter, worked wood in his occupied land. He was apprenticed to his father's trade, and his country paid its dues to the colonial Roman conquerors. He was a working-class Jew. Though conceived 3 months out of wedlock, the stigma never stuck. He began a 3-year public life, but he never made a buck. Because he spoke out against injustice, saw that capitalism bled the poor, he attacked self-righteous hypocrites, and he condemned the lawyer's law. But they've commercialised his birthday now, the very people he defied, and they've sanctified their system and claim he's on their side. But if he appeared tomorrow, he'd still pay the highest cost. Being a radical agitator, they'd still nail him to a cross. You see, he'd stand with the downtrodden masses, identify with the weak and oppressed. He'd condemn the hypocrites in church pews and the affluent, arrogant West. He'd oppose Stalinist totalitarianism, the exploitation of millions by one, and peace through mutual terror, and diplomacy from the barrel of a gun. He'd fight with Joe Hill in Valencia, Mandela in Freire, try to free the third world's millions from hunger and despair. He'd stand with the peasants at the pockmarked walls, and they'd haul him in on bail. He'd condemn all forms of apartheid, and he'd rot in their stinking jails. He'd denounce all dictatorships and mammon's greed, the exploitations of others for gain. He'd oppose a nuclear madness and the waging of wars in his name. He'd mix with prostitutes and sinners, challenge all to cast the first stone. A compassionate agitator, one of the greatest the world has known. He'd condemn all corrupt law and order, tear man-made hierarchies down. He'd see titles and status as dominance, and the politics of greed he'd hound. He'd fight against the leagues of the Ku Klux Klan and the radical racist right. One of the greatest humanitarian socialists was Comrade Jesus Christ.
You're with NITV Radio.
And that was Comrade Jesus Christ by the great Kev Comedy. Coming up next, a conversation with Jack Gilmer, who is about to embark on an art residency in Paris.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Paris Parramatta and the Cité Internationale des Arts in Paris have just announced the two recipients of the Galang Residency Programme, a programme that supports First Nations creatives through two intensive 3-month art residencies in Paris. And I'm happy to say I'm joined by Jack Gilmer, one of the art residency recipients. Jack, first of all, congratulations on winning such a prestigious art residency, and welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's really exciting. I'm excited that I had the opportunity to actually be accepted as part of this Galang residency. I think it's a really unique opportunity. And yeah, happy to be here and have a yarn and let everyone know what I'm going to be up to.
And what was your initial reaction when you found out you were chosen?
Oh, honestly, I was a bit shocked. I was quietly confident at the start, only because I recognised that my proposal was really confident. But after a week of waiting, I started to question myself. I'm like, oh, maybe this isn't quite what they're after. So when they rang me and they let me know the news, I was really excited. I was kind of shaking a little bit. I didn't know what to expect. And I had my little dog with me as well. And I looked at him and got a little bit upset, realising that I'm not going to see him for 3 months, which is a little bit funny. But, that's part of the journey.
You may be able to take him, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Virgin allowing dogs on domestic flights now, but I don't know if we can take them internationally. But I think my partner wants to spend time with him while I'm away, so that'll be a good opportunity for them.
You explore country as the driving narrative of your design practice. How do you envision integrating Indigenous cultural paradigms and knowledge systems into your architectural projects? Because I gather built spaces are some of the areas you mainly focus on.
It's a new intersection between culture and knowledge systems and built environments that's kind of been introduced into architectural that we've kind of had the opportunity to, you know, encourage the voice of First Nations people to participate in the built environment, which is something that I'm really excited about and, you know, excited to explore. And that's kind of what I see my role in architecture as a First Nations architect is a bit of a translator or conduit between the First Nations knowledge systems and the built environment. This idea of two-way learning and making sure that First Nations people can build the capacity and capability within the built environment space, kind of understanding our lingo and opportunities to influence and conceptualize the architectural response to place. And then on the other hand, bringing my built practitioner kind of, you know, friends and colleagues on this journey as well to start to understand that First Nations knowledge system and how that can approach our approach to the built environment. So it's kind of a new space that I've identified as being a space of unrealized potential and endless opportunity that I'm really excited to explore. One of the ways that I do it is understanding a site through the means of its cultural infrastructure.
Yeah.
And there's this quote that I often reflect on by Peter Myers, and he's titled it A Third City. He says, the beginnings of any colonial enterprise are proverbially insensitive to local cultures. So why should we be surprised that Philip ignored or chose to ignore the very definitive indications of an existing urban structure? And the way that I interpret that is our First Nations knowledge system's way of understanding country and place and the stories that are embedded within those mnemonic devices that, you know, we actually use the landscape for to carry these stories and the lessons that are embedded in them. And something I've been really interested in over the last few years is language. I've been learning my language. And I, at the start of the year, I enrolled in a Cert 3 so I could actually be part of the revitalization of education of it, kind of, you know, in technical terms. Because of this residency, I've actually had to postpone that because I'm going to be away for 3 months.
Yeah.
But I'm doing a Cert 2 instead, which means I'll be online. But language has this really important role in understanding that cultural infrastructure of country that lies below the concrete blankets of our city. So it's kind of exploring that and exploring the meaning of place. And that meaning of place then reveals what it is that country was and how country was designed by mother and our creation ancestors. And making sure that the architecture and the work that I'm able to influence in the urban environment can ensure that country flows as intended by design by our creation ancestors and mother. So making sure that water can flow through these systems and that the wind can move through here and that the sun can access these places. So something that, you know, it's quite new and foreign. And, you know, we're trying to build the confidence of, you know, developers and clients and government organizations in this space as well, as something that we should, you know, definitely have a deeper look into in our approaches to, you know, the future of this world and the cities that we live in.
And coming back to the residency, it is said that you aim to open restitution conversations between institutions and decolonize museology through your residency project. Could you elaborate on how you plan to achieve this and the significance of giving agency back to First Nations communities?
So, you know, the summary of my proposal is about restitution and repatriation of First Nations cultural materials and remains. Investigating this in a museum context, so looking at the museum designed by Jean Nouvel, and I'm going to mispronounce this until I go to France and learn a bit more of their language, but the Musée Jules Quay Branly, which was designed by Jean Nouvel, was a museum that was designed specifically for First Nations cultural materials, but, you know, global First Nations communities. And there's been a lot of criticism about the museum, the way that it houses objects, and that there's criticism that they're in a vegetable state. So they're not kind of being celebrated, or they're not designed or, you know, put on display or on exhibition in a way that's culturally appropriate. But I aim to use architecture as a tool to investigate that relational ontology that object has with object, that object has with people, that object has within space and its surroundings and the elements and the institutions that they exist in. So that's looking at it from a design point of view, maybe looking at some design guidelines, but also the kind of the structure and the museology of a way that a museum and institutions like this operate, trying to give agency and access back to First Nations communities.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they'll also learn a lot from you. It's not you learning, they'll also learn from you, because What you just mentioned is something that a lot of non-Indigenous people wouldn't be aware of how the representation and, you know, celebrating art is very important. You just don't put it there and park it as if it's just part of decoration. It has to be celebrated appropriately.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned the importance of collaboration with elders and traditional custodians in your artistic practice. How do you ensure that Indigenous perspectives and voices are central to your creative processes?
Yeah, so it all depends on the opportunity that presents itself with a project as well. And as an architect, I need to make sure that I do my due diligence to make sure that the project actually provides a viable opportunity for the voice of the First Nations elders and community members to be heard. It's not always something that we can achieve, you know, as I kind of, you know, I advocate quite heavily and I kind of, you know, protest in a way in my response that we need to make sure that the voices of community members and elders are heard. And I think designing Connecting with Country is something that somebody can't do as a sole voice. It's definitely a community effort. I think, you know, in a way, a lot of my role is making sure that these clients and these institutions actually recognise the value of First Nations knowledge systems and the ways that that's going to create a better future for not the next generation, but several generations following us.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned it earlier that you're undertaking some studies, and especially studies in Gathang language, to contribute to the revitalization of your ancestral language. How do you see language revitalization intersecting with your architectural work and broader Indigenous cultural preservation efforts?
Like I said before, language is such a unique way of understanding a place and the meaning of a place. So one of the words that I unpack with Uncle Ray, who I have a relationship with, is he kind of introduced me to language many moons ago, many years ago, before I really started to dive into my own ancestral language. And it's the unpacking and the interpretation of a word and a place name. So the Western way of naming a place is after a person. Often I reflect on this quote by Stan Grant at a conference I listened to him speak at. And he said, from a First Nations perspective, I quote Stan Grant, "Language doesn't tell you who you are. Language tells you where you are. And at the moment, our architecture is telling us who we are and not where we are." So, end quote. So by unpacking language off place and a place name, you can start to understand the elements that kind of collide at this place and the meaning behind the stories as well. So there's a headland in Newcastle called Weebaigumba, otherwise known in Western language as Nobby's Headland. And Weebaigumba means wind on and around that place, which totally makes sense when you look at it from a contextual point of view. It's just off the mouth of the river, between the intersection of the river and the ocean. It's got southerly winds that are coming in to impact it. So, you know, there's this wind in and around it. So it's completely contextualized through language. Language is such like it's such a beautiful and poetic way to understand place as well. One of the words that I learned recently, which is quite poetic in nature, is the word maranga, which means in the red, and it's our word for the sun setting. So it's not a word for, you know, sun setting, but it's actually a word for a moment in time that has an atmospheric quality to it, which is quite beautiful, poetic, and it's an incredible way to understand that moment that we're living in. Just kind of pronouncing those words builds this kind of connection back to my culture that, you know, I just love. Like speaking the language has really strengthened my identity as well, you know.
Oh, that's really, really powerful. Now, before I let you go, so something we may not have covered that you'd like to bring to the attention of our listeners?
I guess what I'm really looking forward to over there is the opportunity that the residency provides. And it's the opportunity of, and I would kind of really promote other First Nations artists and creative practitioners to apply for such residencies, because it puts you in a place where you can really focus on something that means a lot to you without distractions as well. So, you know, being home, you have all these distractions of different deliverables, different projects that are coming up, but this really puts you in a headspace that you can really focus on what matters. And, you know, although I'm going to Paris, the real reason I'm going over there is to, you know, really try to make change for our communities. And I hope that what comes out of this study is something that's going to benefit all of the communities of this continent they now call Australia.
Jack Gilmer, recipient of the 2024 Galang Residency Program at the Cité Internationale des Arts, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about this journey you're embarking on. It's really been a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, Marumbu. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Now, if you want to listen to this conversation with Jack Gilmer again, just go to our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We must step aside for another break, and when we come back, well, a rare success story. We'll hear how the government has managed to reduce considerably substance abuse in just a matter of 3 years.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Welcome back. Now, in Australia, the misuse of prescription opioids has been a long-standing problem. At one point, the nation recorded the world's 9th highest consumption of these drugs per person. But as Deborah Grock reports, changes to prescribing rules in 2020 appear to have been effective in reducing this substance abuse.
Done a fair bit of travelling and had pockets of different drugs in different countries, but for sheer choice and volume, it's all here.
That's recovering drug addict Zach McCoy. In 2018, he spoke to SBS about a spiralling crisis facing Australia. A UN report had just found the country to be among the heaviest users of illicit drugs across the globe, with a growing dependence on prescription painkillers. Australia at one point recorded the world's 9th highest per capita consumption of opioids. Jeff Munro from the Australian Drug Foundation told SBS then that people might not have realised the extent of the problem.
Pharmaceutical drugs and pharmaceutical overdoses are now rivaling the road toll in states like Victoria. So more people are dying from overdosing on pain management drugs than are dying on our roads.
Experts like Professor Shane Dark from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre says opioids are a particular type of pain relief medication that's very powerful, and complications can happen all too easily, especially if they're mixed with other substances.
When you look at, say, people, 50-year-old man with chronic back pain, can't work, at home, depressed, drinking, quite often given benzodiazepines to help sleep or back spasms, and they're on oxycodone. It's the same thing. And I don't think people are aware that if you're using pharmaceutical opioids, you may have no history of dependence. You know, any anaesthetist will tell you don't get drunk before we give you an anaesthetic. It's exactly the same.
The spiralling crisis prompted authorities to introduce changes in 2020 to how opioids listed on the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, like oxycodone or codeine, were prescribed and supplied. Dr. Danielle McMullen is a GP and the Vice President of the Australian Medical Association. She says the number of repeat prescriptions were restricted, the level of authorisation required to prescribe some opioids increased, and half-sized packs introduced.
If you've had an operation and you've got some pain after an operation, having a pack of opiate-type medicines that really is appropriate to just the few days that you're going to need that, rather than sending people home with weeks and weeks of supply and not being sure of when to start and stop those medicines, by making them smaller packs, we send that clear signal.
Dr. Ben Daniels from the University of New South Wales is the senior co-author of a new study published in the Medical Journal of Australia that suggests these new rules have been effective.
The primary finding was that overall, the use of opioids accessed through the PBS, so publicly subsidized opioids, they decreased following this tightening of prescribing restrictions around opioids. So all of these medicines can also be accessed outside of the PBS through private prescriptions. And it looks like some people did move to the private market to avoid PBS restrictions. It wasn't the case that everybody just went to the private market. We do believe that there was a true reduction in the amount of opioids that were prescribed.
But for those with chronic pain, it's been bittersweet. Julia Jones from advocacy organisation Pain Australia says it's increased the problems they have often faced.
There's a great deal of grief amongst consumers with chronic pain. And while people do want to keep up with the latest findings and understanding, when you take something away, when there is no replacement, it just creates distress. So while we accept that there needed to be some changes, the way it was done was not really appropriate, and the outcome is a very distressed cohort who were pretty distressed already.
She says the extent of the pain problem in Australia is unrecognised, and we have a long way to go before we address it properly.
Because chronic pain doesn't have a simple solution, people often get treated like they are the problem. So they'll go to a doctor who doesn't quite know what to do with them, and they'll be asked if they're making it up. It'll be asserted that they're trying to drug seek, etc. Now, these are people who are pretty desperate because they don't have a solution to their chronic pain, and they know what life was like before their chronic pain, and the life they're living is very different.
Dr. McMullen says opioids aren't meant to be a long-term answer to pain and stop being effective after they're used too much. She says a conversation needs to be had about how to move forward.
The discussion about chronic pain is heading in the right direction, but we still have a long way to go. Certainly we hear from patients and from doctors that it is still difficult to access that multidisciplinary care, and that's why we're working so hard in that space to make sure that general practice is better funded to be able to provide that wraparound care, because at the end of the day it's about providing patients with what they need to live healthy lives.
Deborah Grawk, SBS News.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
All began by the Steve Jeans, and that's all we have on NITV Radio this Wednesday afternoon. Your program will be back on Friday with more news and stories from right across the country. I am Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Wednesday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu. Yeah,